Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Dr. Matthew Jebb from the Botanic Gardens explains how water gets from the bottom to the top of the very highest tree. Aidan Ilana discovers that it wasn't just Molly Malone who was eating cockles back in the day. And as the next giant leap for mankind is likely to be on Mars, we meet the geologist who's trying to simulate its soil conditions in order to grow plants on the red planet.
I am trying to use microbial organisms to improve soil on Mars to grow plants.
Let me ask an ignorant question. Is there soil on Mars?
Yes, I would say there is. So that is a good question, because some people would say for it to be a soil, there has to be a biological component. That's one of the definitions of soil. But that's actually something that's been changing quite a bit with how we define soil and what makes a soil a soil.
So, a very busy program ahead of us today. That's interesting stuff, I must say, about recreating the soil conditions on Mars, because that's where we're going next. Where will we go now, though? We're going to start by talking to all of our contributors. As always, we're joined by our contributors scattered throughout the country and beyond. And we're starting again in Kilcool, where Niall Hatch is at home. Hello, Niall. How are you today?
I'm very good, Derek. It's great to be talking to you again.
Fancy living on Mars?
Well, ever since I was a small child, I actually have dreamed of going to Mars, but there aren't any birds there, and it's too far away from Burdochern's East Coast Nature Reserve, which is within my 5K for my exercise at the moment, so that'd be a lot to give up.
Richard Collins is in Malahide. Richard, how are you today?
Hello, Derek.
I'm not
in Mars, nor do I intend going there.
Are you telling me if you had the opportunity to take a trip to Mars, you wouldn't avail of it?
Well, the way it works now is that we will be technologically equipped to send somebody there, or some people there, but we will not be technologically equipped to bring them back, which raises the question, would you volunteer to go to Mars and spend the rest of your life and die there?
Well, you got to die somewhere, and it'll be an interesting journey, and hey, you'll have seen something not a lot of people will have seen. But at any rate, let's think of the positive things. Let's go now to Glasnevin, to the National Botanic Gardens, and its director, Dr. Matthew Jebb. Matthew, how's the gardens today?
They are great, Derek. It's at that wonderful time of the year when we've got amazing blue skies and all the trees are changing colour. Although we know we're coming to the dreaded cold and dark months of winter, it is a wonderful last hurrah of the year.
Now, I was with you at the Botanic Gardens last weekend, and we were looking at a very large redwood, and you were telling me how water gets from the very bottom to the very top of even the tallest tree on the planet.
Well, Derek, it is one of the great mysteries that a tree is taking water from its roots to its leaves at the very tip. And a giant redwood, or more importantly, actually, the coastal redwood, will get to 120 metres in height. Now, on the face of it, it seems quite simple. It's a bit like sort of sucking water up. And people can imagine a pump might be able to pull water to the top of a tree. But actually, it defies the law of physics, because whilst there are little vascular bundles called xylem in the stem of a tree, taking water from the roots up the tree trunk, at a height of 10 metres, water will actually start to boil, because once you've sucked water up 10 metres, you have created a perfect vacuum above it. And the water can no longer rise any higher, and it literally starts to turn into water vapour. And this was a problem puzzled over by two professors in Trinity College 120 years ago. John Joly was the physicist, and no doubt he asked Henry Dixon, the professor of botany, how does water get to the top of a tree? Because I can tell you, physics tells us it can't happen. So the two of them put their heads together and came up with a wonderful theory. It's based, if you like, on a thought experiment, which is very important in science. We think how something could be solved, and then we apply all the facts we know and see if it works. So they called their theory the cohesion tension theory. Sounds complicated, but essentially it is that water coheres together. The cohesive property of water is, again, one of the remarkable facts of physics, is water molecules, H2O, have got a positive pole and a negative pole. And like little tiny bar magnets almost, they hold one another together. And these are called hydrogen bonds. And what Professor Joly and Professor Dixon sort of theorised was that every water molecule that evaporated from a leaf right at the top of a tree pulled the next water molecule up the tree. And it formed a chain of water molecules from the tip of the tree down into the roots. Now, critics of the theory said that is like believing in ropes made of sand, that it was bound to snap into two. And yet, we know that trees have been on this planet for 400 million years, so it has to work. There has to be a reason that this theory is the best description that physicists are able to come up with to solve this conundrum.
Matthew, maple syrup comes to mind.
Yes.
Maple syrup is harvested from deciduous trees before the leaves arrive at all. Now, a tree stores sugars, I'm told. When the leaves are about to appear, these sugars are taken up the tree from the receptacles down below on the roots and in the bark. And you can actually hear, apparently, with the stethoscope, you can actually hear the sap rising. Now, I've never heard sap rising, although I've often listened because I was told I could hear it. But if the whole thing depends on transpiration, the conversion of water into sugars up at the top of the tree and the leaves, there are no leaves, so this can't be the explanation. Now, a team in Switzerland suggested that in this chain you described, this chain of infinite strength, electrical chain, that there are actual bubbles forming, bubbles of carbon dioxide, and these bubbles are strung along the whole way, so it's not a continuous chain, and perhaps the bubbles seeking to rise to the top exert some kind of pressure to push the sap upwards. What do you think?
You've picked the very interesting area which a lot of people have applied their mind to it. And what the maples seem to be doing is actually using their phloem, which is something in the bark, and that's what normally takes all the sugars made in the leaves down to feed the growth of bark and the growth of the roots. It appears that at the end of the winter, these maples have suffered terrible freezing, and freezing brings out gas molecules. So literally, the water columns have been ruptured and broken through the big freezes of the winter. And it seems that the maples are pumping sugars into the xylem to actually recover the property of a single column of water from the tip of the tree to the bottom. So the best idea at the moment is that these maples are actually healing these ruptures, these cavities of air and water vapour that have appeared in the xylem through the winter. It is, again, a very, very difficult thing to measure because you're dealing with incredible pressures, negative and positive, in these phloem and xylem vessels. And trying to measure it ruptures it, so it's hard to get an actual figure. But the theory that is proposed at the moment is the sugar maples are literally healing up these gas molecules that have got out of solution in the xylem, and they're preventing it from working. So if it were to produce its leaves without healing up the xylem, they wouldn't be able to function. The transpiration would not be able to pull the water up because the column was broken.
Wouldn't the gas rise up along the xylem? Wouldn't it push its way up to the top?
We're talking of diameters, something like between a 50th of the diameter of a human hair up to about a fifth or a tenth of a human hair. So we are talking about columns that are so small that the surface tension of water will prevent a bubble like that moving. One of the strange properties of water, the fact that the molecules are polar, they've got this positive and negative side to them, means that a water surface is being pulled down by the rest of the pond or the puddle of water, such that an insect can actually walk across it, because to the insect, it's like a hard, elastic surface.
Did you ever do any camping? In camping, you are told never to touch the tent or the water. The rain will come through. And that is exactly the same effect, that you have a chain of electrically charged molecules linking together, forming a bond and keeping the rain out. And if you hit it, you break that chain and the water can penetrate through. But it's hard to believe that the voltages involved, which are absolutely minute, would be sufficient to lift the water up a tree. I mean, it seems still very mysterious.
And that's the pleasure of it, because science means you can have a theory and you can say, right, this theory fits all the facts. And hundreds of publications have appeared on this whole idea of the sap ascending in a tree, both for and against, but nobody has come up with a better theory. So one of the amazing things looking back in history is that John Joly as the physicist, Henry Dixon as the botanist, suddenly realized what everyone had taken for granted as a simple idea required a leap of faith, if you like. Here was an idea, here's a theory, and now let's gather the facts and see if any of them contradict it. So the sugar maple is a classic case in point. And recently, people have also pointed out that the water inside a xylem vessel from the bottom of a tree to the top has never dried out. Those vessels have had water from the day those cells first divided. And the water entering from the roots is ultra-filtered. There are no little bubbles of gas. Because one of the strange things about water being sucked so that it cavitates, it breaks apart and water vapor comes out, is that it has to have a little nucleus. It has to have what we call a nucleation point, which is normally a tiny trapped bubble of air in a polished glass or metal vessel. And that is where the only place that the water vapor can actually appear. So you'll see a bubbling saucepan, especially a glass saucepan boiling on the hob. Those bubbles appear to be coming from a single spot. And that's exactly what is happening. They're coming from a nucleation point. So in these huge tall trees, those vessels that haven't been ruptured by ice cold weather are staying together because there's nowhere that the nucleation point can appear. And the negative pressure in xylem at the top of a tree can be minus 12 atmospheres, which is a staggering negative pressure because, of course, the greatest negative pressure we can think of is just zero. It's a perfect vacuum.
How did the two boys get on in life? Did they get a Nobel Prize in physics or anything like that?
They didn't. I mean, John Joly was an incredibly inventive character. He produced a colour photography method. He also pioneered radiotherapy of cancer treatments. But the two of them had what we'd refer to as a very intense relationship. Mm-hmm. And John Joly was some 15, 20 years Henry Dixon's senior. And Dixon looked after his affairs on his death and arranged for him to be buried at Mount Jerome Cemetery. And Henry Dixon himself is buried in the same grave. So they are united in death. And clearly their partnership in life gave us some fantastic insights to the way the world works. So it's an extraordinary reflection, I suppose, of the tolerance of Irish society back in the 30s and 40s.
Are you suggesting they were having a relationship, Matthew? You say the tolerance
almost
of Irish society.
But no one needs to worry or pry into such a matter. But
no.
I think one can say that the wording that they had an intense relationship reflects that. Henry Dixon certainly had a family, and it's none of our business, so to speak, but it is a reflection of the benefit of that sort of college life, that collegiate approach that the two of them were able to work on these ideas. And bringing physicists and botanists and chemists, geologists together is one of the great insights of how well university life often works.
Now, Matthew, you're going to be interested in this story that Niall has, and you too, Richard. Olive oil is no longer a threat for migratory birds. Please explain, Niall.
Yes, this is a bit of good news that we've heard this week, and it might be an issue that most people weren't aware of. I certainly wasn't aware of this problem until just a couple of years ago. It turns out that nobody was. It all stems from a paper that was published in Spain in 2018, and it was cataloguing the effects of nighttime harvesting of olives in a big commercial olive oil production in Andalusia. And it turned out that what was happening was when our olives were being harvested at night using big sort of vacuum suction machines that would go around the trees, they're also sucking in a very large number of migratory birds, particularly warblers like blackcaps that would have migrated down from Ireland. They were sleeping in the trees, they were roosting there and getting sucked into the machinery and being killed by the actual workings of the machinery when the olives are being extracted. It wasn't known that this was a big problem, but what the paper did was extrapolate how much was happening. They found out that there were roughly 100 birds being killed per hectare per year, which means in Andalusia alone, that would be 2.6 million birds a year.
Oh dear.
And then if you extrapolate that all across Iberia, through Spain and Portugal, where olives are a very important crop, we're talking a very large number of birds. And the thing is, many of those, certainly several thousand, maybe even hundreds of thousands, would be birds migrating down from Ireland, because we know that many of our migrant warblers pass right through Iberia and would sleep in those olive groves. So this was an unknown problem, but what happened was conservation organisations sprung into action. It really showed the power of the BirdLife International partnership as well, which Birdwatch Ireland is a member of. Our partners in Spain and Portugal particularly, they lobbied for action. There were calls for boycotts in supermarkets, but what happened was they eventually managed to persuade the governments in Portugal and in Spain to completely ban this mechanical nocturnal harvesting of olives. And so the problem has gone away overnight. So now it is, as you said, now safe again for birds to consume European olive oil. This is no longer a problem across Europe, which is really good news.
Happy days. Now, let me take you back to the 20th of July, 1969.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That was Neil Armstrong back in 1969, the first person to set foot on the lunar surface. It was President Kennedy who said, "I believe this nation should set itself the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth." And that's exactly what happened. But he never mentioned Mars. And now all these years later, it looks like that's where we're heading next, to live. But before we can do that, we need to figure out how we can sustain life on the red planet. Now, one person who's been doing a lot of research into this subject, and in particular, how to grow plants on the surface of Mars, is a PhD candidate from the University of Georgia, Laura Frackery. We can talk to her now from her home in the United States. I know it's a little bit early there, so thank you for joining us, Laura.
Yes.
Tell us about your work.
So I'm a graduate student at the University of Georgia, and I study geochemistry and geomicrobiology of Earth and other planets. That's kind of a big mouthful for basically right now saying that I am trying to use microbial organisms to improve soil on Mars to grow plants.
Let me ask an ignorant question. Is there soil on Mars?
Yes, I would say there is. So that is a good question, because some people would say for it to be a soil, there has to be a biological component. That's one of the definitions of soil. But that's actually something that's been changing quite a bit with how we define soil and what makes a soil a soil.
And how different to the soil on Earth do you imagine it is?
It's pretty different from what we've seen so far. There are similarities, and the same elements are available in both places. So, of course, there are many things that are the same. But there are, for example, Earth is such a dynamic system that has a very active biological cycle, but Mars doesn't have that as far as we know, at least not currently. And so that's a big part that's missing. And so it has a soil in the fact that it has a developed portion that's separate from the bedrock, and it's not necessarily part of the regolith, or it's part of the regolith, but the regolith includes more than just that part.
Matthew.
Laura, that's fantastic stuff. I mean, I think a lot of us will have watched the film The Martian, Matt mm-hmm. Damon trying to get a crop of potatoes out of the soil. And indeed, like you say, the biological aspect, the fact that soil is not quite an mm-hmm. organism, but an ecosystem that so many plants seem to be dependent upon. I mean, the work you're doing is also trying to match chemistry that is so far away, trying to work out how it does and doesn't react to living things. I remember one of the early examinations of the soil on Mars suggested that it was biologically alive. And then, of course, the nagging question of, well, was there some other chemistry involved? At that time, I think it was perchlorates, highly reactive oxidizing substances that were present in that soil. Overcoming that is obviously going to be the biggest hurdle, is it?
That's one of the hurdles, yes. And I think the answer to the question was, yes, perchlorates, they have found more evidence of that now. So not just that reaction from the first experiment, but now they actually can measure it with the different instruments on the Curiosity rover. They've measured evidence of perchlorates. So we're very sure that there are perchlorates on Mars, but it's not in every sample.
Yeah.
And even though they're common, the actual concentration is low.
If you went to the Atacama Desert or to Greenland and so on, even here on the planet Earth, it can be fantastically difficult to know if you've found life in some of the most inhospitable soils that we know on the Earth.
Yes, our ways of detecting life have improved vastly, but they're very dependent upon certain things like DNA and specific types of biological components like lipids. And so we look for those specific things. And so if life on Mars has those things, then I think we have instruments that we could develop to find signatures or at least remnants of those things. But we don't have any guarantee there. So yeah, even detecting life on Earth has been difficult, but we've vastly improved it. And we've discovered a lot of new organisms because of that, that live in these very interesting environments, from super cold soils in Antarctica to the deep biosphere down in the bedrock, which is absolutely fascinating to me.
Laura, the image conjured up is of geodesic domes, vast big spheres, golf ball-like, which protect your creation from the damage that the Martian environment will do to them. For instance, you have much lower light levels on Mars than you have on Earth because Mars is further away. You have huge amounts of ultraviolet light and no protection from that light. You have dust storms which can last for months, apparently. Gravity is much lower, about 40% of what we have. So you're creating a new ecosystem, unknown on Earth or anything like it on Earth, presumably in this controlled little bit of Earth up in Mars. Is that what we're doing?
Yes, and I think that's the right picture to imagine. So we're not trying to terraform an entire planet, at least not at this stage. I think we're still quite a bit away from that. But yeah, I think you have this little bubble, this controlled environment within which you have materials that you've used from the surface, but you also have to then bring in this biological component and kind of complete the system and create a sort of an artificial ecosystem almost.
Well, now you're going to bring up creatures. It's an ecosystem, as Matthew said. You're not. You're creating an ecosystem, not just putty. We tend to think in everyday life that soil is just putty, but it isn't. It's a very rich, complex thing which took millennia to produce. Now, you're going to have that up there. Now, what organisms are, how do you select creatures to bring up? Are you fearful that if you bring up the wrong thing, you could get chaos up there?
Yeah, that's a great question. The thing that I'm focusing on is those things which are involved in agriculture. So in agriculture, there's the particular group of bacteria and fungus and different microorganisms, usually referred to as plant growth promoting, is the term that's often used. And they're very popular in agriculture right now. Another hot topic is called biofertilization, where you're actually using these microorganisms as part of a fertilizer that helps replace, at least in portion, chemical fertilizers, because it helps the soil to be more dynamic and have more diversity within the microorganisms in the soil. So for the agricultural aspect, you want to bring those types of organisms that are known to be plant growth promoting, and they're usually non-pathogenic too, so they're not going to be something that's going to infect anyone. But how they react to the Mars environment, that's a whole other question. Is at the same time, those are just chemicals, and so they're reacting to a basaltic soil, essentially. And so we can prepare for a lot of that and test a lot of that before we ever go there with humans.
Matthew mentioned earlier the film The Martian, and in that film, of course, Matt Damon's character was trying to grow potatoes on the surface of Mars, and you mentioned, of course, there was the lack of the organic component in the soil there, and as I recall from that film, the organic component he ended up using was human waste from the space mission that had gone to Mars. Is that one of the key components that you'd be looking at, obviously trying to make use of as many resources that would be on Mars as possible?
Yeah, I think it's not one of the things that I'm specifically looking at, but it's certainly part of that, one of the solutions that needs to be considered, is that organic matter isn't required for plants to grow, but it usually houses nutrients and it can improve soil texture, and so it's a very useful thing to include in the soil. And it can help the plants to grow, to just have extra benefits that it wouldn't have without it. And so using urine, for example, to create nitrogen fertilizers. Nitrogen is on Mars, but there's very little of it that we found so far. And so we need more of that. And so that would be a very good source to find that particular nutrient. And then other human waste, if you process them correctly, then can be used to kind of add to that soil. You could also use plant waste from a previous harvest to kind of add to that organic matter as well. So anything that you can recycle and reuse definitely is something that you can need to consider a resource for a planet where you can't like cart Walmart with you. You can't bring all the, and so you have to be able to reuse everything that you can.
I don't want you to break any official secrets act or anything when I ask you this next question, but has the American government tasked you to actually do this research?
No, it has not. This is just the topic that I wanted to look into as part of my doctorate degree.
We were discussing at the top of the program, would you go? I asked Niall if he'd go, and he doesn't want to go because he doesn't want to leave the birds behind. There are no birds there. And I asked Richard, would he go? And Richard said he's not going on a one-way journey anywhere. So would you go? I have to ask you now.
I think where I am right now, I probably wouldn't necessarily go because I don't think we're quite there yet. I'm more fascinated by the actual science of it. I want to understand the interactions. But I don't necessarily think I want to make a one-way trip, so to speak, yeah.
Do you think that someday we will be there? And do you think that someday we will actually grow plants on Mars, on the surface?
I think we can get there. I think it's possible. We have the technology that we could do it. Now it's just a matter of that time and that effort.
Well, it's a long way from cockles and mussels. It'll make sense in just a moment. But at any rate, Laura Frackerell, thank you very much indeed.
No problem. Thank you.
Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first set my eyes on sweet Molly Malone, as she wheeled her wheelbarrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh, alive.
Right. We're going on an imaginary walk along the seashore. This is actually a field trip by sound. And we're walking along, crunching through the seaweeds. And we come across, because it's a sandy shore, we come across lots of shells that have been washed up by the tide. Now, these shells are the homes of shellfish that are long dead. So we can get different sorts of ones, but all we have are their homes. Now, there are two sorts of shellfish. There's ones that have two shells that close together, and there's ones that just have one shell like a snail. So the one shells like a snail are things like winkles, they're things like dog whelks, they're things like top shells, gorgeous things like that. And you poke a little piece of wire in to get the food out. But the other ones are two shells closed together, and they range from oysters to mussels to cockles to scallops. All of those ones have two shells. And a lot of the time when we walk along the coast, we see cockle shells and we see clam shells washed up from further out. Because these are the creatures that live buried in the mud. When the tide comes in, they come up to the surface, they stick up a little finger yolk like a siphon, and they suck in their food out of the actual water themselves. And that's when the tide goes out, down they go, and you never know they were there at all. So catching them to eat is quite difficult. You have to wait till the tide has gone out. You have to go out with a rake. You have to rake them out. You have to be really hungry to do this because the water's freezing. It's usually dawn or dusk when this is happening. And then you bring the wretched things home. You wash them. You put them in the pot. You boil them and they open out. And if they were full of mud and sand, your pot is full of mud and sand. Then you have to strain the whole thing through a sieve. Then you have to wash all the sand off it so you don't break your teeth eating them. And there you have your mussel meat then, or your scallop meat, or your meat from the cockles. And the cockles, of course, are very abundant. So when, if you had nothing else to eat, you'd be very glad of the cockles. But if you boil them too much, it's like eating rubber. Now, people ate them during famine times. People were glad to eat anything then. But nowadays, we're all too posh. We're not going to be doing this any longer. So people around Ireland do not eat cockles, anything like as much as they used to. You might have the odd clam, you might have mussels, because they're much more tender. But the cockles are for the hardy souls. However, I'm going to talk to Kate today, and Kate has been doing a PhD on cockles. So she might be able to sell it to us a bit better than I have just done, do you know? Hello, Kate. How are you?
Hi, Ina. It's absolutely perfect, thank you.
Why are you doing a PhD on cockles?
So cockles are a really important species around Europe. And in Ireland, culturally, we have many, many links to them. And I suppose everybody would, the first thing they'd think about is Molly Malone selling cockles and mussels in Dublin. But alongside that, I always hear people speaking about their grandparents collecting cockles, or else they remember doing it themselves when they were children. So there's loads of cultural links to cockles. We know that they've been in Ireland for a long time. So there's shellfish middens from a long time ago. So what these are is ancient rubbish heaps. So we know that people were eating cockles prehistorically. But as well as the cultural side of things, they're obviously very important ecologically. There's lots of different bird species that feed on them, crabs and fish. But they also work as ecosystem engineers. So what that is they bury into their habitat and they alter the mud that they live in. So they create a habitat for other species. And then finally, one of the very important sides of these of cockles around Europe is their importance to economy. They're very important. There's fisheries all around Europe, but there's also an untapped potential for cockles as well, for their byproducts. So this is for things like aggregate for building or for poultry grit and even for things like crafts. So there's loads and loads of reasons that we study cockles, but that's the general sum up of why.
Now, you're going to find out, obviously, I'm sure, more about cockle biology. How does the cockle start in life? How does it grow? And what are the effects of climate change? So, obviously, there is an effect of climate change on cockles because the sea temperatures are the ones reflecting climate change first. So, can you tell me, have you found anything out about the impact of climate change on cockle growth?
Yes, we have. So we've had a really interesting study out in the last couple of weeks. So what this study was is we looked into the history of cockles. So people kind of tend to look at the data that's just been collected in the space of their own career. But what we did was we took loads of different sources of data. So that's from newspapers, museums, fisheries reports. And overall, we gathered an awful lot of data. And what we did was we compared this to the sea surface temperatures in Europe. And we found that, interestingly, as the years with higher sea surface temperatures, cockle density, so that's the amount of cockles in an area, was lower. So what that would say is in cooler years, cockles are actually doing better.
So the colder, the better. So in 2010, when the country was at minus 16 in places, did we have an outbreak of cockles? Was this the best year ever for cockles?
Surprisingly not. And so that's a very interesting side of things. So cooler temperatures in the sea surface, when we're looking across the Atlantic, it's not taking into account these extremes. So that year in, say, for Dundalk, for example, we saw lower numbers of cockles there. So the extreme temperatures are actually bad for them. So while cooling temperatures are good, these extremes, which are likely to increase with climate change, are becoming a bigger factor and likely to impact them into the future.
So can you tell me, really, just lay it out for us, the life cycle of the cockle. The cockles that we would know and see in the fish shops are actually two shells stuck together and the piece of meat that we might eat is inside. But that's the very much the grown-up cockle. How do cockles start? How do they get embedded in the mud? How do they grow? How do they feed? Can you give us a potted version of the biology of the cockle, please?
They reproduce by spawning. So they release into the water, and that's when they spend their first stage of the life cycle as small little free living animals. So they're in the plankton, essentially. Eventually, then they settle down into the sand or the mud, which is where they're generally found. And they're very small little animals at this stage. They stay then where they are. Occasionally, sometimes they will move. So they have a stage in their life where they might move into another area. But generally, they'll stay in that one particular spot. So they bury into the mud or the sand, and to feed, then they come up to the surface and they have this part in their body called a siphon. So what the siphon does is it takes the food and brings it into their gills, and that's how they feed. So they'd be feeding on things like phytoplankton and bits of broken down plants and algae, and that's where they get their nutrients.
So there's really then, if you like, two important stages. First of all, when they're the tiny little free living creatures, the temperature of the water in that instance is very important, because they're actually up in the water column swimming about, and water temperature changes would impact on their survival, I presume.
Yes, correct. But the water temperature would also be impacting them when they're living in the mud as well. So it seems to be something that would impact their whole lives.
True, but they mean when they're in the mud, they're down at the bottom. When they're swimming around in the water column, they're up nearer to the surface where it's even warmer still. So that would affect them more. But anyway, they sink down to the mud and they become embedded in the mud and they live their lives in the mud. Now, you were saying in your introductory remarks that they actually change the mud in which they are buried. How do they do that? What do they change it from to? And how is that impacting on other species then?
Yeah, so that's actually very interesting, because they do different things in different areas. So in some areas, depending on whether it's sand or it's mud, they will either stabilize or destabilize the sediment. So what that means is they might make it more likely to erode and change, or they might make it less likely. So, of course, it's very dependent on the areas that they're living in. But in terms of creating habitat for other species, they're not the same as species such as oysters or mussels that would typically create a reef. Instead, they are within the sandy substrate themselves. So species that tend to be found around them, they create habitat for species such as, there's these pea crabs which live inside in cockle shells. So they are small little crabs, but they also are habitat for lots of other species as well. So they're very important within the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, when you buy cockles and you cook them and open them, you quite often get the little crabs inside. And mind you, you get them in mussels too. They're not only in cockles, but they're filter feeders. They suck as through their siphon the water, and the food that's in the water comes into them. So in Dublin Bay and other places where the water quality long ago wasn't hectic because there was so much bacterial contamination, they concentrated the bacterial contamination in their bodies. And if the bacteria were those of typhoid, which is what happened in the time of Molly Malone, eating the cockles meant that you got yourself a dose of typhoid, which is why poor Molly died of the fever. So what's the situation about them and water quality? How do we know when we buy mussels that they haven't been filter feeding some dreadful bacteria into them that'll do us harm?
Well, lucky for us, we have monitoring in Ireland that classifies the waters where fish and shellfish are being harvested from. So during the year, you'll find that the Marine Institute will release a notification saying, please don't pick shellfish at this time of year because they're higher in toxins. So that's how we would avoid it. But we do have, say, cockle fisheries in Dundalk where the water would be nice and clean and the cockles do very well there. So they wouldn't be a threat to humans for eating. But this is monitored regularly.
Another impact of climate change is the fact that our oceans are becoming more acidic. The pH is actually dropping. And of course, the shells of the cockles are made of calcium. So is this going to have an impact on the amount of calcium available for cockles to form their shells in the first place as the seas become more acidic?
Yeah, it's very likely, and it's been seen in other species with mussels and oysters. But unfortunately, with cockles, there hasn't been a lot of work done yet in it. So it's very interesting, especially when it's such an important species that we don't have the answers for those important questions yet. It's important that we understand what's happening in other species and we can apply that to cockles. But the research does need to be looked into in cockles to find out what is going to happen in the future under ocean acidification scenarios.
Kate, I want to ask you about the economic importance of the cockle shells. I mean, once the cockle meat has been eaten, you have all of these shells, these vast conglomerates of calcium. And you're saying that they have quite a lot of use. Would you like to expand on that, please?
Yeah, so we recently had a paper published with colleagues across Europe. So what we were looking at is what economic value do cockles have, the meat as well as the shells. The shells themselves can be used, so they can be used in building as aggregate for construction, but as well as poultry grit, because they don't form the same kind of shards that that oyster shells, for example, would form. So it would be much safer to provide the poultry. But then you can always see, in especially in places like Spain and Portugal, they're used in craft purposes. So for souvenirs and for personal use as well. So I know I did see recently in a shop in Cork a packet of cockle shells used for home use. So there is, aside from the meat side of things, there is an untapped potential for cockle shell to provide for coastal communities.
So this is really a potential thing rather than something that's actually happening at the moment. You're saying that this is an area that could be looked into rather than that it's happening on any large scale at the moment.
Yes, that's it exactly.
So you're talking about your colleagues. Who you're here in Ireland doing this PhD in Ireland. With whom are you collaborating with? Because you're speaking to me about us and ours and the groups and the gangs. So who is collaborating with you on this?
This work is all part of the Cockles Project, which is quite aptly named. So what that is, it's looking for the restoration of cockle fisheries across Europe. Obviously, in Ireland, we have a long history with cockles, but in Galicia, in Spain, in Portugal, in the UK and loads of countries along the Atlantic area, cockles are also really important. So we have colleagues from all around Europe that are involved in this project. So it really isn't just one country, which is what makes it so interesting. We're tapping into the knowledge that everyone around Europe has about cockles to try and learn more about them.
I have to take you up on the fact that eating cockles is something that's been happening in Ireland. I mean, since the famine, we've stopped eating cockles. Be a buck. We can afford to go to shops and buy food. I never grew up eating cockles. I come from the area around Dundalk. I went to school in Dundalk. There was never a cockles to be had. If the cockles are in Dundalk Bay, they're not ending up in the fish shops to any great extent. Irish people, I put it to you, do not eat cockles to any great extreme and haven't done so since famine times.
Yes, and I'd agree with you on that. The cockle fishery in Dundalk, for example, has only been a major thing since 2001. So a lot of the cockles that we fish in Ireland are actually exported. So in, especially in Galicia and in Portugal, that's where the cultures there put a strong, strong importance on eating cockles. But in Ireland, unfortunately, yes, it was the poorer people in the past who fed on them, and it's kind of gone out of fashion now. People don't seem to eat them anymore. It's probably a shame that they're so embedded historically in our culture that we don't have them in our diets anymore and they're exported instead.
Do you like eating them yourself?
Personally, no, I don't. But I have heard from very many people that they're absolutely gorgeous.
Well, no, you have to put your mouth where your money is, don't you? Cockles are lovely, actually, but you have to, you know, work on them. They're full of sand. You have to strain them. You have to boil them until they open, but not so much that they turn into rubber. So it's a certain skill with cooking cockles. It's been great talking to you, Kate, and may I wish you the best with the end of your PhD. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Aina.
Aina Nilan is speaking there with Kate Mahoney, a PhD candidate of Biological Earth and Environmental Science at University College Cork. what a difference a day makes. Only in this case, it's a week. This time last week, the weather was most definitely autumnal with those magnificent colours on the trees and bushes. But now the leaves are pretty much all gone and wind and rain have taken their place. So apart from the plants, what effect is the changing weather having on our wildlife? Terry Flanagan has more on this from his home now in Dublin 15. Terence.
Well, Derek, we are in November, and traditionally, November is considered the first month of winter, so what can you expect? And yes, our wildlife will be noticing it too. Take the spiders, for instance. They're active at the moment, looking for a warm place to get away from all this cold weather. Lots of people will be seeing Incy Wincy in the house. And speaking of spiders, we had an interesting call from Dublin listener Jim Nolan. He's been watching the spiders in his garden, and he's pretty sure that he's got an unusual one. He thinks he's got the false widow spider, and he asked me over to have a look.
In here, Terry.
Right, so we're into the back garden here, and we've got a metal kind of fencing, and I'm looking along the side of it, and yes, I can see quite a number of spiders there.
Yeah.
Okay, you're going to try and catch one of them.
There's one there, Terry. Hang on a second. Oh, got him.
That's one, okay. But the one we're looking for is, I think, this one here.
Yeah.
This black one.
It's the black shiny one, sorry.
Do you see him? Oh, he's gone. As soon as the light hit him, he's gone.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on then. Because the fence is about, what, 10 or 15 metres long. There's another one here. Just look. Yeah, they seem to be right in the corners.
They are.
Now, there's one there. Can you see him in there?
I'll just have a go, Terry. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Yeah, got
you
him.
Have him.
Got him. Got
you
him.
Have him.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Put him in. Make sure you put the cover on there.
Yeah,
right, okay.
I have him. Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Just looking in at him there now. He's very black, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Now, this is the guy that you're concerned about.
Yes, there's a shiny black, and he's much, much larger than the regular spiders, Terry.
Yeah, yeah, and look at the back. It's kind of arched, isn't it?
He is, yeah, yeah, and very bulging as well. Very, very shiny, and a big black bulge in the back of it there, you know?
So this is a spider that's appeared here in the garden recently, and you're a bit concerned about
it. I am. I'd read about the false widow spider.
There's another one there. Do you see him? He's just gone in. As soon as the light hits him, they're extremely fast.
Extremely fast, Terry, yeah.
Anyway, sorry, cut across you.
A neighbour came across a false widow last summer.
Now, the false widow is a worrying spider to have in your
garden.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, so I've heard.
So a neighbour came across?
Yeah, a neighbour came across and captured the black widow, or the false black widow.
The false one. And it was identified?
Identified, and people were just alerted to be very, very careful. Apparently they can give a nasty bite or a sting.
Right. Now, so where we are here now, we're in your back garden, and you have it fenced off. You're doing a little bit of gardening here at the back, and you've got this metal fence, and it's kind of louvered, and it's in between the sections here where this... Or these particular black ones. There's another one there. Do you see him in the corner?
There,
so that's about six or eight or so we've seen so far.
Yes, roughly, yeah.
How many do you think are here?
It's hard to count, Terry, but I mean, it's a concern. You see, the regular spiders are here as well, but there's far more of the regular spiders. But there's a.
But even though there may be more of the other spiders, it's this one that's worrying
this
you.
This is one of the large black ones, yeah.
Well, it is a worry. And what I would like to do is I'd like to take some of those samples that you have there. And take them away to an expert to let him have
great
a look.
Stuff, appreciate
there
that.
May be nothing in it, but you're better off knowing what it is.
What you're dealing with, yeah, exactly, Terry. Appreciate that. So we've got a half dozen there, so if you have a look at them.
Okay.
And we can... let me know what they are.
Okay. Yeah. Well, look, I'll get back on to you as soon as I have a result.
Perfect, Terry. Appreciate that. Very good.
So you managed to capture some. What did you do then?
Well, I was pretty curious myself, because this particular spider just didn't look like any of our native ones. So I headed off to see Collie Ennis. Collie is a zoologist working in Trinity College. And if anyone could identify our spider, then it would be Collie.
Yes, this is a false widow spider.
How can you tell?
Okay, so I'm going to show you one I have here.
Now, I should say that we're surrounded by lots of living specimens of spiders, hundreds of jars of spiders.
Yeah, so yeah, these are my collection of spiders, tarantulas, scorpions, lots of different
and a
arachnids.
Large snake here
a
on my right hand side.
Well, yeah, mainly spiders. And this one here, this is a false widow, and actually quite an interesting one. You might have passed by him when you were walking around the Aurus with us. So when we were doing our biodiversity audit of the Aurus, we collected this false widow.
I can see him there. He's just under that leaf.
Yeah.
And about the same size as the one I've brought up to you.
Yeah. And you can tell it's a false widow because it has a very shiny, bulbous abdomen. At this time of year, they'd be full of eggs. They also have a skull pattern. It's a white and brown kind of skull pattern on the abdomen. and kind of light brown and sometimes even reddish legs. And that's the pattern you look for to identify this species. The problem with false widows is sometimes people misidentify them as native species. Also, like ourselves, as they get older, their hair gets grey a little bit, so their coloration will change. It's the same species, but it might lose that distinctive pattern that it has on its
back. That ID that we might be able to use.
Yeah, exactly. So you're always better off consulting somebody in the know, an expert who will be able to positively identify.
Now, they're not native.
No, they're not. They're introduced. They've been in the UK for a couple of hundred years recorded. They were first recorded in Ireland about 20 years ago by arachnologist Miles Nolan.
And how would it have gotten here?
We live in a very global society, obviously. We ship in tiles and fruit and goods and all sorts of stuff into our country, and spiders and insects, and obviously bugs as well will travel on these goods. And yeah, that's how they arrived in the country.
And how are they settling here then? Because Ireland is a cold country.
It is, but spiders and arachnids in general are very adaptable animals. They've been around for hundreds of millions of years and they're great survivors. And the problem of our climate has been overcome by the false widow by basically hanging around human habitation.
So inside houses?
Inside houses, outside windows, even in sheds and garages, they find that quite sheltered and it gives them enough warmth to survive our cold winters.
Now, this one that I've brought you, this one was actually in a fencing outside a house, but it was kind of louvered, so there was lots of little places that it could hide into. And the one thing about it, I was amazed how fast it was in trying to catch it.
Yeah, they're incredibly fast little spiders.
How common are they in Ireland now?
Oh, they're widespread throughout the country. They're nearly in every county, so they're getting around very fast. And again, one could get on a car, a gravid female full of eggs could get on a car, make a nest on the underside of it. That car could be driven across a county line and spiderlings will come out and spread out. And that's how basically they're spreading
now,
around.
Are they venomous?
The reason why we kind of get so worried about them and worked up about them over here is twofold. It's the fact that they are the first venomous and medically significant spider that we've really had in this country. And secondly, it sells a lot of papers. It gets a lot of clicks online when you write a story about a highly venomous spider.
Well, should the public be worried about them?
No, that's what I was just about to say. The truth of the matter is that they are less venomous than their cousins, the true widows. Their venom is medically significant, and my colleagues in Galway, in NUI, have been in the venom lab up there, Michelle Dugan and John Dunbar, have been doing tremendous work in breaking down the actual toxins that make up the venom and sometimes the effects that it can have on people, which can be quite nasty. So it is important that we know and are aware of them, and I think the work that the lads have done up there is really important.
So what if a person is bitten by one of these? What should they do?
Well, the best thing to do is to try and catch the spider if you are bitten, or at least take a photograph of it so you can identify what it was that bit you. And basically, if the bite area becomes too painful or it looks nasty and infected, I would recommend that you go and see a doctor about it, and they can take it from there.
Now, are they in competition with our native spider?
Well, the short answer is really we don't know yet, but it does look that way. Everything is leaning towards that, because you will see that they actually live a lot longer than our native spiders. They many times when we've been out looking at them in the field, you'll find the carcasses, the chewed up carcasses of native spiders in their webs. So there's a high probability that they are, you know, out competing and even feeding on some of our native species, but it does warrant further investigation.
Now, they are an invasive species, so should we be thinking about removing them?
Well, it's impossible at this stage. I mean, it'd be nigh on impossible to remove them without badly affecting some of our own species. You know, you can't just go around gas and hedgerows and areas where they are. So it's just a case of learning to live alongside them and becoming aware of any medical threats, albeit small medical threats that they might pose. And they're not aggressive spiders either. They're not going out of their way to attack you. They're not going out of their way. It's generally like one will be in your jacket and you put your jacket on and it feels pressure. And obviously, like any animal, will try to defend itself. So again, it's important that we get a balance between respecting the animals and understanding that they can pose a slight threat to us. And the other balance is not to be jumping down the stairs if you see a spider crawling across the land, and you have to be careful that you don't worry people too much.
If you want to see some pictures, go to the website rte.ie/Mooney. While you're there, have a look at the pictures of the last remaining adult female swan and her cygnet in Blessington Street Basin. Regular listeners will know that we've been following these swans for the last few months from their very first swim, and it all began with an adult female mute swan and her six cygnets. The male had disappeared the day before the eggs hatched, so I'm told at any rate. Well, everything was going well until a month or so ago when one died, then another died, then another died, and last week another two died. So on Friday, the decision was made by Dublin City Council to call in the Kildare Animal Foundation Wildlife Section to take the swans from the basin and bring them for some rest and recuperation. And that's exactly what happened. And yesterday I spoke to Dan Donaher and he told me that they're responding very well to treatment. So we'll have a full report for you next week. But meanwhile, you can see the pictures of one of the volunteers, Lisa, and the swans in the back of the car before transportation to Kildare. So thank you very much indeed, guys, for the wonderful work you're doing there. We really do appreciate it on behalf of everybody who enjoys nature and wildlife. And if you're wondering where those swans are, that's where they are. You can see the pictures on the website and we'll have a full report for you next week. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Aina Nilana, to Dr. Richard Collins, Dr. Matthew Jebb, to Niall Hatch, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly. Until next week, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.